Good evening, this is Lesbian Nation, and I have an announcement for you from the Gay Alliance of Queens County, which presents The Women's View, Gay, an open discussion for all concerned individuals. There'll be speakers from GAA and Lesbian Feminist Liberation. Everyone is welcome to attend, Thursday, January 31st at 8:30 p.m. It'll be at the First Unitarian Church, 149th Street at Ash Avenue in Flushing. There's a suggested donation of 50 cents. I suppose if you want to give more, you can. And for travel information, you can call the Gay Switchboard, 924-4036. Gay Alliance of Queens County meets regularly each Thursday at 8 p.m. at the above location. You may be able to tell by my voice tonight that I'm sounding very hyper and I've had 30 cups of coffee. Why don't we play a little music to calm down?
I had a dream and it left me feeling caresses and whispers embracing me, a kiss of the goddess, the lips of the lover, the blessing of precious woman's love, loving, loving woman, loving, easy, warmly, so peacefully. In the beginning,
from Lavender Jane, which you can buy at Labyrinth Bookstore and probably also at Oscar Wilde. I don't know if they have it at other places around the city. Next, I have a letter from a subscriber. Dear Martha, I have tried to listen to your last two programs. I gave up on the first one but stayed with the last night's interview till the bitter end. It confirmed my worst fears of what Ms. Kennedy is all about, elitism and the undermining of black-white feminism. I kept waiting for her to discuss the National Organization of Black Feminists or make a positive statement concerning women on any subject.
Instead, all I heard was half-baked psychology on her own contempt for women. Her metaphor of the ball game with herself and a few others in her league on the field, with the rest of the women in this world to be kept in their place in the stands and kept out of the way, was the most revealing and male-oriented statement I have yet to hear any woman make who claims to be part of a movement based on sisterhood. There are women who have the courage to call things by their proper name and could tell Miss Kennedy that the white racist women she referred to are programmed by the same worship of white male power structures as she herself is. I believe she has a vested, if unconscious, need to want women to feel that some women are more equal than others. I, for one, will not listen to her push her own interests under the guise of feminism and or lesbianism. Despite her rhetoric re-lesbianism, it doesn't quite ring true when grouped in her mind with prostitutes and welfare mothers. To an elitist like herself, you'd better believe you're just another nigger by her standards. Your listeners are serious and sincere people who want to hear from women who care about this movement and each other. Well, I'm going to have to take the blame for some of this, because the following week, I'm going to have an interview with another representative of National Black Feminist Organization, and I did cut out some of the things Flo Kennedy had to say in order not to duplicate information. However, tonight we're going to hear some more from Flo on the Chesimard case and on Bobby Seale and his campaign in California. If any of you want to debate this, please write me letters and I will read some serious ones on the air.
We talked about you getting involved in the Chesimard case, and from what I read in the papers, Joanne Chesimard took over her own defense with you assisting, and I was trying to figure out what that meant. I mean, she was being a sort of lawyer for the defense?
Yes, she was on the legal team, and I think a great deal of the credit for the acquittal goes to her. I think that Bob Bloom was as cool as a male, you know, white lawyer could be in a situation like that, and he carried the load for the defense in that he cross-examined for, let's say, 45 minutes to an hour, and we would sort of come in for 5 or 6 minutes apiece. But I still think that he was a little nervous about her participation as a part of the legal team. But I'm sure that Bobby would be the first to agree that she possibly, as much as any other single thing, except the work that Bobby and Evelyn Williams had already done, were responsible for the acquittal in the Chesimard Hilton case. Her manner was brilliant. She gave us the list of questions that she would ask, but she made them all herself. We did not help her with forming the questions. We suggested pulling a couple out that we thought might lead into difficulty because, you know, the person on the stand could twist it around and turn it against her. But she was so intelligent that she cut the cross-examination at the point where the witness attempted to turn on her and use it to sort of incriminate them. And her manner was so impressive. I know the jury had to be impressed. And I am very, very strong, and maybe it's because I don't practice law on a regular basis, or in fact at all, except in a case like this, which was like an emergency situation. But I am so high on the idea of people who are not attorneys being involved in legal defense. Not only their own defense, by the way, Martha, but in the defense of other women. I am so convinced that it would make a great difference in the courts if more women were representing other women as well as themselves in matrimonial cases. And even where they had a lawyer, I think that if the women were acting in some paraprofessional context, whether in the cross-examination or as witnesses, but one of the reasons the court is so powerful in oppressing women in certain kinds of situations is because of the isolation of the female party, whether it's the defendant or the plaintiff in the case. I really agree with Emily Goodman and Diane Shelder and other female lawyers, Carol Lefcourt and others, who are trying to arrange it so that women can be more participatory in the litigation. And this does not just apply to women, it applies to black people and to males in criminal and civil situations. I feel that the lawyers of the oppressed communities must share their knowledge of both the procedural and the substantive. I know that the participation in the Panther trial of Afeni Shakur made a very, very large difference. And I think it made a difference in Afeni. And I'm hoping that she's going to run for the city council from the Bronx. I've tried to persuade her to do that. And I hope that she will do it. Because I think we need also to work at different levels. I wish you could have been on the West Coast to see how impressive the Bobby Seale campaign was, where he outran about 6 people that they threw into the race when he tried to run against the incumbent. And ultimately, he and the incumbent had to have a runoff because he prevented the incumbent from getting the necessary percentage to be the automatic candidate. And in the runoff, his votes totaled something like 46,000.
I have read some movement stuff on the East that said that he basically repudiated Panther politics and revolutionary principles and sort of ran as a reform Democrat. I wasn't on the West Coast and didn't follow the story, and I wonder what your response is to that.
I think that kind of report is an example of divide and conquer tactic and strategy. Even if he did change his rhetoric in order to get racist white votes, I think that anyone who was friendly to the Panther Party could not write such a thing. You see, the white community has need to divide up the black community and the left community, if there is such a thing. And I think that anybody that used that kind of rhetoric in a public media would be doing so to turn off the various groups. I certainly think that it would have been suicidal and asinine for a Panther to run in a predominantly white community, although there's a large percentage of black people in Oakland, and talk in the same way that they would as a group talking within its own house. I think that any person who talks to a general community would have to talk in broader terms. And I think it would only be suicidal and masochistic and counterproductive for him to talk in exactly the same way. He did certainly not abandon the principles of black liberation. His setup was predominantly black. His rhetoric was very consistent with what Panthers have said. In the first place, the Panthers have always talked about the community. They've always talked about the breakfast programs. They've always talked about better housing. They've always talked about better education for black people. And when he talks like that, he is talking Panther talk. The 10-point program is not all about getting guns any more than Nixon's talk is all about getting guns. And he's got the Pentagon and $13 billion Trident missile submarine program. But what congressman does come out and talk about the money that they plan to waste on space and highways and all? So I think that his program was just as close to the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party as it had any reason to be. And when people talk like that, I put them down immediately as an enemy and a stupid person beside, because if they're not working for the government, they ought to be. Because he did a fantastically beautiful campaign, and the number of votes he got was evidence of it, and he had black people working. I went over there with my London cab that I now have out in California and hauled people to the polls. He had a map situation. He had food at every headquarters. He must have had a dozen or more headquarters, each one perfectly staffed with, usually with young black people. It was the most beautiful spectacle you'll ever want to see. And he didn't abandon anything, or those young people would not have been there.
Think he's going to run again?
I certainly hope so, but whether he does or not, Oakland will never be the same. Elaine Brown, who ran with him, was absolutely gorgeous. And she was one of the black women who attended the California meeting of the Women's Political Caucus. And that was interesting because that was the meeting at which the black women showed that if we are going to be in feminism, we're not going to be, you know, gingerbread women or chocolate bunnies. And I think that, you know, some of the white women were practically in tears, and they were not the most political of white women, or they probably might not have been in the Women's Political Caucus. But the black women gathered together. I had a suite at the hotel where we had the meeting, and black women from the National Black Feminist Organization was not that big at the time, but there were some small chapters out there, and there was another large group of black women called Black Women Organized for Political Action, BWAPA, and they had raised several hundred thousand dollars at various times, usually for male candidates, and that's going to be a difference between the black feminists and the black women in politics and the white women in politics, because there will be times when the black women, because of the disrupted family and the unemployed male, when the black women will be pushing black men, and I understand that, and that's something that the white feminist has to come to understand, that their priorities will not always be the same as the black women's. They've raised money for Willie Brown, who is an assemblyman in California, and for Ron Dellums, maybe $100,000 and $50,000 here and there. And these are women who are not necessarily feminists, but very conscious, very political, and very, very smart. And they include some feminists, but predominantly black women organize for political action at the electoral level and other levels. And again, they are so sophisticated, and they had the Women's Political Caucus ready to blow their brains out and jump out the window, because they came in with accusations that they were very racist, and that the black women had no, you know, a part in organizing the state convention. And the Chicano women piled in, and the Asian women piled in, and there were about 15 non-white caucuses, no, about five, I guess, six, maybe the Samoan women and the Indian, Native American Indian women. And it really drove them crazy. And I think that the feminist movement keeps thinking they want black women in their movements, but when it comes to the kind of women that are in some of these groups, they're really not ready for black women except for ornamentation, and black women are not coming into feminism for ornamentation. So that's going to be an interesting development to watch.
Finally, we're going to have a review by Viv Sutherland on Because I Said So, which is now playing at the InterArts Center.
Good evening. This is Viv Sutherland. Definition: catharsis. The effect of certain kinds of art, especially tragedy and music, in relieving or purging the emotions of an audience. Definition: cathexis. The investment of emotional significance in an activity, object, or idea. The Women's InterArt Center over on West 52nd Street is currently playing host to Myrna Lamb's newest production, Because I Said So. I took the trouble to haul out my 20-pound Random House Dictionary of the English Language to read you those two definitions, because Ms. Lamb has billed her show as a cathexis, and I wasn't sure what it meant either. Now that we've gotten that straight, Because I Said So is a collection of seven of Lamb's works, all of which, of course, invest emotional significance in an activity, object, or idea. That's not really so surprising, seeing as how Myrna Lamb probably does that as well as, if not better than, anyone I know. Starring in this cathexis are Marilyn Redfield, Myrna Siegel, Wendy Simon, Diana Spencer, Elizabeth Tibesley, Mary Tiffany, and Connie Van Ess. Probably the most powerful piece in the show is the first, The Two-Party System, which features all seven women. The lights come up on a party scene, champagne glasses a-clink, nebulous party small talk afoot. The ultimate representation of every cocktail party either you or I have ever been to. The talk flows apace with the liquor, centering at first around the gossip-bitter fact that the husband of one of the characters is being successfully vamped by the hostess. Did I say one of the characters? Well, they're all so different, these seven women. Old, young, ambitious, defeated, hopeful, helpless. Different? They are, we discover eventually, the same woman. Seven manifestations of one personality. Woman with a capital W. The point is that as different as we are, you and I, we are far too much alike and share too many of the same problems to be divided as society has divided us. But as many times as I have heard that stated, never has it been done with the force and clarity as it is in the two-party system. To quote Anselmo de Olio in Women in Sexist Society, a frequently heard comment about Myrna Lamb's work is that it is written in a highly complex verbal shorthand, that her plays are in fact full-length works compressed into a time slot of well under a half an hour. In truth, the shortest of Lamb's one-act plays contains more dramatic meat than most three-act plays. However, I do not believe that this is from a lack of desire to develop the play's theme. She spares us the slow torture of a two-hour reenactment of our habitual follies, and in return asks that we follow her fast, deft strokes carefully. True, all true. In a span of perhaps 20 minutes, we are, in addition to the initial theme of quote-unquote fidelity and the relationship of a man to a woman as it comprises the woman's ego, Confronted with childbearing as a factor of the female identity and the loss of ambition necessary to the attainment of same within our society. Lamb repeats her theme in The Serving Girl and the Lady, which follows on the bill. Horizontal hostility at its most virulent, expressed in the relationship between the servant and her mistress. Both oppressed as all women are oppressed, silently, subtly, with and without malice aforethought. Allowing society to divide them in their oppression as women have been divided for millennia, unable to refrain from turning on each other in their inability to turn on the oppressor. Specifically in this instance, the husbands of both women, who, through the use or non-use of sex, exercise complete control over both. The analogy to be drawn in relation to the world at large is all the more apparent for the effective staging of the piece. It is no accident that each of the seven parts of Because I Said So centers around a single prop, a black-draped bed. The bed serves various uses through the evening, pretending at times to be a chair, couch, counter, and so on. Somehow, it always ends up as a bed. In The Worker and the Shirker, we're given an average American couple. He's completely caught up in the masculine mystique, wanting his wife to be only, merely, the perfect possession she was raised to be. She wants something more, something different. But unable to define exactly what that more and different is, she succeeds only in trading one oppression for another. I should mention that there's a rape scene in The Worker and the Shirker that had me halfway out of my seat and onto the stage before I was able to bring myself out of the play and back to reality. Extremely powerful and magnificently acted. Iphigenia is a one-woman play performed by Elsabet Tebessely. I, for one, found that this piece hit so close to home that I now have difficulty discussing it. Iphigenia is at the altar of her dead father, Agamemnon. She speaks to him in tones of quote-unquote madness of blood sacrifice, the blood sacrifice of Iphigenia herself. As women are eternally caught up in a monthly blood ritual, as we are all our father's daughters, so is this piece drawn. As her body arches on the bed altar, as her throat stretches to meet the shining blade of the sacrificial knife, I cannot yet describe the harmonics which were set off within me. I still don't know exactly when during the performance of Iphigenia I stopped breathing. I only know that somewhere towards the end I found myself gasping for air. To have followed this tour de force with monologia is an incredible bit of genius. The monologue is performed by Marilyn Redfield in a man's suit, three-piece, slightly flashy, complete with hat, with a style strongly reminiscent of the title character in that old bromide, The Music Man. She speaks of her mother in the gunshot patter of the carnival hustler, recounting how her mother went off to work when Marilyn was just 2.5 years old because the job paid $25 a week. I could never have paid $25 a week. If I could have, she would have stayed home. The emotions raised by the image of her quote-unquote complete acceptance of her mother's leave-taking, coupled with the visual impression of that ultra-businessman suit, embellished to the hilt with every masculine gesture ever devised, hands in pockets, fiercely jingling change, rapid striding to and fro across the stage, broad gesticulations with every word. These set off a new series of thoughts on not just mother and daughterhood, but also the masculine mystique and the capitalist ethic. This was followed by what is most likely still my favorite Lamb work, Beautiful Man, a sarcastic view of man as the virile, mighty leader of our species. I don't know if I'm supposed to like Beautiful Man for the way its neat, easygoing lyric style makes its finely honed point, but I do. The last one-act piece in the set was In the Shadow of the Crematoria. Here it becomes clearer that the oppression of women is also an oppression of men, and we all live in the shadow of the crematoria. Played by Connie Van Ness and Stephen Mandillo, this is the penultimate seduction scene. She refuses to compromise her principles until he promises her love. And in the process, it is obvious that he is as much a prisoner of his role as she is. Neatly punctuating the plays are four songs, only three of which, unfortunately, were performed the night I was there. Been Down So Long, Food is Love, Take a Knife, which was the one omitted, and Yesterday is Over, all of which prove that Myrna Lamb is as good a lyricist as she is a playwright. Go and see this show, but I warn you, don't plan on doing anything strenuous for the following week because you won't be able to. Because I Said So, at the Women's Inter Arts Center, 549 West 52nd Street, 8 p.m., Friday through Monday, January 25th through the 28th.
That was Viv Sutherland. I'm Martha Shelley. Good night. I'll be back in 2 weeks on Tuesday, I think.